This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, remove a tissue from language's pocket before putting it in the washing machine. This episode is about a project to reconstruct the lost language of extinguished peoples, and the surprises you can find about the people who had written it down. Content note: in the episode there is mention of slavery, genocide, and the mistreatment of indigenous people of what is now known as the United States of America. Also, if you have trouble hearing anything in this episode, or any of the other ones, remember, there are transcripts of every episode at theallusionist.org/transcripts. And if you hear snoring during this episode, it's not me. It's an interviewee's dog. It is not me. On with the show. Tumukwa is somewhat underreported in scholarship of like indigenous languages and literacy.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think it was virtually undescribed until pretty recently. So these documents have existed for a long time, but because there are no longer Tumukwa speakers, I think that many of the details of how the language worked were very obscure until pretty recently. There's still a lot of open questions. We still don't know what other group of languages it might be related to. It's what linguists call an isolate, just meaning we don't know. But an isolate is sort of like an orphan linguistically. So we know that it does have some kind of parents or some family it belongs to. We're just unable to say what that might be at this point based on the evidence that we have. Because it's not related to any other language that we know, because there were not any native speakers, because there's not a dictionary from the colonial period, all of those things were big obstacles in making much sense of Tumukwa language structure and grammar until pretty recently. My name's Aaron Broadwell. I'm a professor of linguistics and also a professor of anthropology at the University of Florida.
And I'm Alejandra Dukowski, and I'm a professor of history at the University of California, Riverside.
What are you working on together?
What are we working on? We're working on translations of this amazing 17th century Tumukwa language materials, or a language that was once spoken in what is now northern Florida.
The Tumukwa encompassed around 35 different tribes of indigenous people living across a large area of what is now known as Florida and Georgia. Although these were separate tribes, they had some shared culture and politics, and they spoke dialects of the Tumukwa language.
And when the Europeans first came, there were a very large number of Tumukwa people. It's hard to estimate how many there might have been. Some estimates are in the range of 100,000 of them. But very unfortunately, these people were the victims of a lot of very bad things historically.
When the Spanish arrived in Florida, there were an estimated 100,000 to 200,000 Tumukwa people. Just two centuries later, the Tumukwa population was down to 100.
They were allied with the Spanish, and the Spanish were losing control of Florida at that time. So there was a lot of warfare right on the border between the English and Spanish colonies. There was also disease, and there was also slave taking. So this population was greatly, greatly reduced. And when the Spanish left Florida and gave up St. Augustine to the English, they left to go to Havana, Cuba.
That was in 1763, and they took some Christian Tumukwa people with them.
So some of the Tumukwa ended up in Cuba. Others probably intermarried with other native groups of the Southeast, although that's pretty unclear, but that's probably what happened. Other Tumukwa people were probably sold into slavery, and maybe their descendants live among descendants of African Americans in the Southeast somewhere. There are not a lot of people who identify as Tumukwa descendants, but that's probably because not a lot has been said about Tumukwa people until pretty recently. So we have had some contacts with a few people who have a family history that says that they are descended from these people. We think that we'll probably find more people over time. But that's kind of where they were. And so the dates that we know about them are from the first European contact in the 1560s or so, up until about 1780s, which is about the time that the Spanish lose control. And we don't know when the last speakers lived, probably maybe the early 19th century might have been the last time that someone spoke the language.
But the Timucua language was partially preserved in texts. Going back a few years down the Allusionist back catalogue, we talked in the key episodes about some of the translation and reconstruction methods used with languages which have no remaining speakers and not much in the way of explanatory materials. Here's how Aaron made progress in understanding Timucua.
Getting to read the Timucua original was a really hard problem. Maybe I first glanced at these materials more than 20, 25 years ago and kind of decided the problem was too hard, that it was just impossible to read the original, you know, without a good grammar or dictionary of it. But linguistic software has gotten a lot better. And there's some free, powerful linguistic software that a lot of linguists use that allowed me to put in a lot of the Timucua text and then use the computer to help me search for certain kinds of patterns in the data. And it was through that kind of computational method that I started to crack certain parts of the grammar of the language. And once I kind of understood the grammar and I had hypotheses about the meanings of the words, I could start to put together what the original Timucua says. So there was kind of a long journey of grammatical discovery with me and Timucua, slowly working out what it all means. And I think I understand the great majority of Timucua grammar at this point, but there are still, you know, difficult passages in there. There are some, you know, unexplained little thickets, basically, where the Spanish is not parallel and the Timucua is saying something complicated that I still cannot read. But I have hope that at some point I'll be able to read all of it. Just at this point, I can read most of it, especially the clear parts, and I can sort of understand what they are saying.
Aaron and Alejandra have around 138,000 words written in Timucua language to work from, and most of the words are in the form of missionary texts. A writing system for Timucua was developed using the Latin alphabet by the Franciscan missionary Francisco Pareja, who taught some Timucua people to read and write, then published several books in Spanish and Timucua, catechisms and other religious tracts, and a Timucua grammar.
Right, and these texts are the oldest text in a Native American language from the U.S. They're written many, many decades before anything earlier from the U.S.
So how come Florida is thus honored?
Florida is one of the first places where the Spanish established a colony. So in 1565, they established the city of St. Augustine, Florida. And then in the decades that followed, these Franciscan missionaries came from Spain to try to convert the local people to Christianity.
They're only going to towns in which they've received an explicit welcome. I think this is really important. It's not like they're setting shop and people are coming to them. It's the other way around. In fact, it takes an uprising in 1656 for that to change and for the missions to really much more follow a Spanish model. And these spaces are really indigenously driven and dominated.
There were surprisingly few Franciscan friars out there in Florida trying to convert the locals. Only about 70 at peak Franciscan friar.
These Franciscans depend on Native people to feed them, to bring them grain, to provide for them, to bring them water, all those things. And these are spaces in which the Spanish are trying. They very much understand that they need to work with the language if they're going to have any success, because they're not basically Spanish is not the dominant language that's being spoken at this moment of time.
And so part of their process of conversion involved establishing some schools where the kids learned to read and write their native language. They didn't have a written form of the language before the Spanish, but the Spanish missionaries worked out a way of writing it using the Roman alphabet, and they taught it to the kids in these schools. And then they translated Catholic religious material into the language and taught the kids to read the catechism, the confessional, that kind of thing.
These are also used for the Franciscans themselves, so they can learn to properly take and grant communion and perform all the sacraments, you know, confession and the like, so that it can be also done not just in Spanish or Latin, but in the Tumupua language. So they could be, in theory, right, better ministers of the faith by communicating with the indigenous people in their own language. So these are texts that are supposed to be indoctrinating for other people, but also tools for themselves to guide.
As we heard from Caetano Galindo earlier this year in the episode about Brazilian Portuguese, it was often easier for European Christian missionaries to learn the languages of the people they wanted to convert, rather than make them learn a whole new language, then be converted to Christianity.
But you also see a lot of native people see it upon themselves to learn Spanish, right? So you see sort of some Tumupas who are learning Spanish in the documents who are serving as translators and who are playing a pivotal role in this process.
The Spanish colonizers and the Tumuqua, were they using each other's language to an equal degree?
To some degree, we don't know. But in most colonial situations that we're able to observe in the world, what we see is that most of the burden of bilingualism falls on the native people. So they are kind of obliged to learn the language of the colonial and not so much the other. We know that the Franciscans, to some degree, could speak Tumuqua and could communicate and maybe lead prayers and things like that.
And in this early 1600, we're in this moment where really there's a big push to learn and work with indigenous languages. And Pareja, Francisco de Pareja, who's the main Franciscan who works on Tumuqua, he's not the only, but he's one of the main. He spends a long time sort of praising himself about how important it is to work on this language and how he gets on his high horse and then provides a bunch of examples that basically prove doesn't have as much control of the language as he thinks he does.
I think maybe the civil authorities, like the soldiers, the state power in St. Augustine, probably could not read Tumuqua. So I think that the Spanish often relied on native interpreters to do their work. Probably the people most likely to have been bilingual would have been native people and Spanish religious officials.
What do these texts look like? There are some where you've got both the languages side by side, right?
Right. One model is the two languages in two columns, like Spanish on the left and Tumuqua on the right. Those are usually the simplest text, where the Spanish is just maybe like one sentence. But then we also get these really complicated things where there'll be like three or four pages of Spanish and then four or five pages of Tumuqua after that. So one of the problems for the linguist is you have to figure out how to match those two things with each other, which is extremely tedious. And another thing that happens is the Spanish is only like four or five lines, and then there are four or five pages of Tumuqua after that. So the Spanish is just a little summary. It'll say something like, you know, God created the world in 7 days, blah, 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 etc. And then it goes into Tumuqua, which just goes on and on and on with lots of details about this. Those are some of the most interesting parts of the Tumuqua literature. They don't have any Spanish translation. So we're reading those for the first time, and we can read some parts of that and not others. But like a cool example is that the text describes the creation of different things that live in the air and on the land and in the water. So there's a long list of things that live in the water. You know, we know the words in there for whale and certain names of fish, and we can guess at what some of the others of them mean. But it's kind of a nice list of living things.
And the Spanish has none of that, right? So the Tumuqua gives you a sense of, you know, people, especially coastal Tumuquas who are they're doing some farming, but the majority of their food is coming from waterways, is coming from gathering. And so it's just a really different way of understanding the world, right? The Spanish are saying, you know, the world was created in 7 days. There we go. And Tumuqua writers sit down and think about their own world and document it.
Usually, religious documents like these don't give you that much insight into the people writing or translating them, because there's not colloquial language or scenes from everyday life in there.
And they're so boring. They're not joyful to read. You know, they're repetitive. They're, you know, doctrinal. They're heavy. So they were not exciting texts necessarily to work with, except perhaps like these momentary sections within the text that sort of seem to describe something particular about Tumuqua culture and life.
We're just going to take a short hiatus for my continuing existence in capitalism. This episode is sponsored by Catan, the board game where you settle the fictional island Catan, which is previously uninhabited, so you don't have to do anything even approaching genocide to the people who were already living there, because there weren't any. Instead, you and your fellow players can politely, and without shedding any blood, build and trade with each other. And if you do want a translation exercise while you play, Catan has been translated into more than 40 different languages, so you have options about which one you want to play in. And when you've played all of those, there are the expansion packs. Catan is a board game for 3 to 4 players aged 10 plus, though younger kids can play with initial adult guidance. And yesterday my husband said, "Can we play Catan, just the two of us?" And according to the internet, maybe we can, if our imaginary friends happen to ghost us. Get Catan at catanshop.com/illusionist. Listeners of this podcast get 10% off the original base game Catan by using the promo code illusionist at checkout. Often not good on other Catan titles or merchandise, but is good on the original base game. Thanks to Bombas for sponsoring The Illusionist and for making the most comfortable t-shirts, undies and socks. And along with their usual array of sock colours, lengths and purposes, they have some delightful collabs. They've just launched their new collection of socks featuring Pixar characters. If you get the calf-length socks, you get 2 characters per pair, 1 per sock. Forky to the left, Woody to the right. The Pixar socks are available for adults, kids and toddlers, all of them featuring Bombas's usual attention to your pedalic comfort, such as a honeycomb of arch support, seamless construction, no slip technology, cushioned footbed and a heel knitted to cup your foot, and the toddler socks have little grippy bits on the soles. James P. Sullivan and Mike Wazowski wouldn't want you to take a spill when toddling around the factory, after all. Get the new Pixar socks and all the other Bombas products, go to bombas.com/illusionist and use the code illusionist for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/illusionist and use the code illusionist at checkout. And now back to Temukua with Aaron Broadwell and Alejandra Dobkowski. The Temukua text is not a direct translation of the Spanish, often far from it.
So one of the things that we started to notice really early on in looking at these documents is that the Temukwa does not say the same thing as the Spanish. So the text almost are never exactly the same. The Temukwa almost always clarifies or explains in some way, adds something or omits something. And we started to get interested in the patterns of what's added or omitted from the Temukwa. And so a very general pattern that we found is that pretty often the Spanish text says something fairly negative about traditional Temukwa practice. For example, we've got a text that says something like, "Did you engage in the devilish practice of whistling at the wind in order to make the storm stop?" And then when we can properly read the Temukwa, it just says something like, "Did you whistle at the wind to make the storm stop?" So the Temukwa writer is doing this editing function of taking out certain parts of the Spanish. So early on, we see the Temukwa writer has their own voice. They take things out when they disagree with them, or they add things in as well when they think that the Temukwa readers need more context or more explanation.
Yes, it's not just a moment of Spanish bad translation. There's active agency in these discrepancies between the Spanish text and the Temukwa text. That the removal of these condemning language that's like violent and definitely harmful language that's just absent in the Temukwa text in these key moments, right, where the Spanish is being very damning. And all of a sudden, we're like, this is huge. The moments of like mistranslation where you see sort of not just like a misunderstanding, but a sort of a different text that emerges.
For instance, in the Temukwa rendition of the story of Adam and Eve.
We all know the Spanish, you know, sort of blaming Eve, you know, her choices, you know, her ability to be so persuaded by the snake, you know, and like, and this is not the first time, but we've seen moments where women in the Temukwa version get sort of more limelight than in the Spanish. The Spanish often have them as they're part of the sentences, but they're often not like tied to any verbs, you know, they're just there. But in the Temukwa, they have action to them. They're doing things or making choices. Often they speak in the Temukwa and they don't speak in the Spanish. And Temukwa Eve is just, I mean, She's just a badass. She says she wants to eat this apple. You know, there's, you know, this, whether the snake wants it or not. And she, in the Tumuku, it's like almost like you're hearing her thoughts. She's thinking. And she sort of says, like, if you know, if I take this to my husband and he eats this, he's going to be the boss of me. And I don't want him to be the boss of me. Like, I want to be the boss. And so she eats the apple. And the word she uses for boss is she uses the word parakusti, which is a Tumuku word for war chief. So not just any chief, but a very particular military position of power, which is traditionally, I have not found women in that role. So it's, I'm guessing it's traditionally men. So here, you know, here in this incredible translation of it, that, you know, the woman is just not only far more active, but has a lot more sort of choice and agency in her story. And again, the negative is, it's almost gone from that. It's like, you know, you're supposed to understand that that's a bad thing, that she wants to be the boss of her husband. But in the Tumuku, it's not necessarily, you know, maybe the parakusi element of it is hinting at a transgression that she's making, but it's not, doesn't have that component. And that is just extraordinary. That was one of my favorites.
The Tumuku version is also more frank about sex than the Spanish, where the Spanish text says, speaking with some woman or embracing her or taking her hand, did some alteration come to you? The Tumukwa version does not go for a euphemism like alteration. It says, did you get excited and did the flesh of your body stand? Boners. It means boners.
I was also going to mention that if you just read the Spanish text, it has a very sort of a European stereotypical view of gender and marriage. But we know from other kind of evidence that the Tumuku had a third gender role, and that marriage practice was substantially different than it was for the Spanish Catholics. And so when you look at the questions in Tumuku that deal with marriage, one of the things you notice is there's just a general word that means spouse. There's not different words that mean husband and wife. And there are no genders in the pronouns either. The Spanish might say something like, did you forgive your wife when she walked with another man, right?
Walked,
right? And the Tumuku will say something like, did you forgive your partner when they wanted to have sex with another person? So no genders there in the Tumuku. And so what we see is that if you're able to read the native text, what you get is a far less stereotypical gender situation. You get a Tumuku text that's much more flexible in terms of the genders or identities of the people involved.
Absolutely, and it insists on it, right? So as the Spanish text very clearly sort of asks questions that are gendered, you know, that very clearly says, like, your wife, your husband, your man, your woman, and there are words in Tumuku for man and woman, right? That Tumuku is not using those words. And like, we'll get caught in this ourselves. We'll be translating and all of a sudden we're like, did the text actually say man? And we go back and go, the text never said man. And we have to go back and sort of take out our own gendering that we, you know, as we translate.
Something else that caught Aaron and Alejandra's eyes was a section of text where the Spanish questions Tumuku food practices.
This is this particular section which is asking about what the Spanish call superstitions or ceremonies or practices. And again, using kind of clearly charged negative Spanish. So these are not like, oh, what were the customs you did? There's a sort of damning element even to the structure, where the way the Spanish are asking. And there are questions about food in there and the ways in which Tumuku people consume food, preserve food, pray over food. How do you fish? And do you pray in any particular ways after catching the first fish? Or even after creating your first trap, do you pray over that? And the Spanish are saying all those things are bad and sinful, right? Because you shouldn't pray over your fish weir. You shouldn't pray over your new catch. You should just pray to the Virgin. You should pray, you know, to the correct Catholic order. You shouldn't be praying. That's heathenism. That's pagan. You see questions. The Spanish are curious in efforts often to clamp practices down. But they are asking about, you know, all that. And you have to understand that for a lot of these instances, they are fully dependent on native people feeding them. So they are paying attention to this world, in part because they need to survive in this world. You know, they're not in a comfortable space where they're the majority of people look and talk like that. They got to be on people's decent graces if they're going to, you know, eat the next meal and survive the next day.
Yeah, it does seem like a bold move to neg the local culture if you
right.
don't want to die.
They do that too. There are two surviving letters written by Tumuqua people. These letters, the 1651 letter and 1688 letter, begin to give us some sense of the, sort of the tremendous violence that's occurring in these spaces. And I think this is very important because there's a way in which mission history can be very sanitized. And I'm rooted here in California, and there's a huge wave of rethinking the missions in California, and there's thinking about the incredible violence, and you know, the word genocide is really much on the forefront of sort of California and mission studies. That is not at all where Florida missions and historiography is at all. You know, I think I just even documented the fact that these spaces are not just learning environments, but in fact, very oppressive. The Franciscans are recording practices they want to clamp down, and you see in other documents from the officials that are recording the sort of drastic population decline as a result of disease, as a result of abusive labor practices, as a result of people migrating out, right, because they don't want to be part of this.
You might also ask a question like, who were the Tumuqua writers that we're talking about? Mostly we don't know their names because the Spanish never gave credit to native people for writing and translating things. But certain particular styles, word choices, or spellings allow us to identify different authors in the text. So, you know, like author A, author B, author C. For some of your listeners who might be familiar with, for example, the Hebrew Bible, we know that there probably are different writers in there too. You know, like there's the J author and the E author and so on. You know, that you can tell by different word choices they make in the Hebrew text, you know, in the same way we can identify different authors in the Tumuqua text.
They do have a small handful of names of the Tumuqua writers, the people who signed those two letters that were written in 1651 and 1688.
Even their names themselves tell you this like deeply colonial story, because they will all sign with a Spanish name, often with the honorific marking Don. So they'll be like Don Pedro, but then they'll say Olata, which is a Tumuqua marker for a chief or someone of, you know, ranking or authority. And they include their town name, often both the town name in Spanish, you know, San Pedro, San Pablo, whatever, and then the Tumuqua word next to it of that. So even in their signing in the 1688 letter, and if you think about the 1688, we're talking 100 plus years after colonization. So this is deep in the process of the colonial. We always say colonization is a process, not a one-time event. Well, here we are deep in that process. Even in the names that these writers assign themselves, you see this sort of hybrid effort of who they are as Tumuqua people writing in their own language and using all these honorific markings. That letter is amazing, as Aaron has alluded. They are very clear about who they respect and who they don't respect. That only comes out if you work on the Tumuqua language.
What ways were the Tumuqua people using writing as a sort of tool of resistance?
In one of the early conquistador stories, right, where you have like very, you're thinking of first encounters, you know, sort of aliens coming, meeting for the first time. Native people do often things of like tricking the Spanish by putting up fake crosses and things that look like letters to trick the Spanish. So even in the earliest, the understanding of writing as a tool or a technology that indigenous people can use themselves for their own purposes to undermine Spanish goals. It's there from the get-go, and definitely by the early 1600s, when these become part of the way Franciscans are communicating, Tumuqua people really readily pick this up as a way for them to, you know, of course, to learn the Catholic faith and communicate it, but also to interact with one another, exchange information across vast distances and the like. But there's also sort of all the literary resistance that we've been talking about sort of expressing their own beliefs within these really religious texts, but instead of expressing condemnation to their own beliefs or downgrading them, preserving them, in fact, sort of maintaining records of them and expressing them in ways that are not, that beyond like not being condemning, they're in fact sort of preserving and enduring of the Tumuqua language and ideas and expression. So I think that's sort of a literary resistance that's there too.
Alejandra mentioned this 1656 rebellion. It's called the Tumuqua Rebellion. We know from the history that it was partially organized by chiefs sending written letters from one village to another. The letters have not survived, but we have historical accounts that mention these letters, Tumuqua language letters going back and forth between the chiefs to help organize the rebellion.
also using the written word to write petitions to the crown, to write petitions to the governors. And that's a very common practice throughout the Spanish Americas of petition making. So the fact that Timucuas are engaged in this sort of inter-indigenous process of resistance gives us a sense they're sort of really plugged in to how to not just understand the colonial world, but sort of how to fight against it as well.
You can think of writing as a kind of technology that originally the colonials bring for their own purposes to kind of use to control native people. And that way it's kind of like the horse or the gun. But these kind of technologies very quickly get out of control and native people appropriate them and use them for their own purposes.
You heard from Erin Broadwell and Alejandra Dubkowski. You can find more of their work on Timucua at Cebuano.org, where you can learn Timucua grammar and vocabulary and look at some of the texts. Erin's book of Timucua grammar is due out in 2024, and Alejandra recently published the book Talking Back, Native Women and the Making of the Early South. I'll link to all these things at theillusionist.org/Timucua. The Illusionist is sponsored by Ravensburger, makers of jigsaw puzzles for ages from infant to infinity, and pieces from 2 to 40,000, and many numbers betwixt. Ravensburger puzzles are the puzzles of choice for the World Jigsaw Puzzle Championships. The 2023 event just took place in Spain. 622 competitors from 54 countries competing through various rounds of speedy puzzle assembly, 500 pieces for individuals, 1,000 pieces for pairs, and for teams, 1,000 and 1,500 pieces at the same time! All these puzzles are as yet unpublished Ravensburger puzzles. They should be available in the 2024 Ravensburger catalogue, having been tested by the world's best puzzlers. So if you fancy competing in the 2024 World Jigsaw Puzzle Championships, you should get started on your training ASAP! But you can also just do them for fun, at a non-competitive pace. Shop for Ravensburger jigsaw puzzles on their official websites and wherever you get your puzzles. The Illusionist is sponsored by Squarespace, your one-stop shop for building and running your own website. And here is my prediction for the next iteration of the internet. Blogs are gonna make a comeback soon. Firstly, because we've already been through a 1990s revival, which means the early to mid-2000s are gonna be back. I mean, they already are, with the Lindsay Lohan essence. I'm not saying I want it to be 2005 again, and I will not be digging out my old MySpace passwords, but a return to blogs, where writers and creators of many kinds can publish what they want without gatekeepers on a platform they control. Because after the blog peak, we were then all ushered to social media. Got to win at social media, adapt yourself to the algorithms. Well, we're seeing how that is turning out, so get your own website. Go to squarespace.com/illusionist for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code ALLUSIONIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/illusionist, offer code ALLUSIONIST. The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and if you want to help keep it going, then recommend it to someone. The best way, I think, to find more podcasts we might love is word of mouth, or word of typing fingers. Actually, figuring out synonyms for expressions that aren't quite covering it is one of the things we do in the Illusiverse Discord community, membership of which is one of the perks if you become a donor at theillusionist.org/donate. You also get behind-the-scenes info about every episode, and fortnightly live streams where I read from a different dictionary from my collection, and we have regular watch-alongs together. At the moment, we're watching the new season of Great British Bake Off. Later this month, there's Death Becomes Her. And we learned from our watch-along last month of Legally Blonde that the subtitles, asterisked out, ass, including in words such as asset and associate, which only served to make some fairly drab terminology seem saucy. Join us for thrills like these and so many more. Theillusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is Nival, adjective, of or relating to regions of perpetual snow. Try using Nival in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, on the unceded ancestral and traditional territory of the Musqueam, Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Music and help was provided by Martin Austwick of PaleBirdMusic.com, and the podcast Neutrino Watch and Song by Song. Our ad partner is Multitude. If you have a product or thing about which you'd like me to talk, sponsor the show. Contact Multitude at multitude.productions/ads. Seek out Allusionist Show on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, the Chalk Outline of Twitter, and you can hear or read every episode, find links to more information about the topics and the people therein, donate to the show, and see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, all at the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.